some more before using that. All right, so it's a pleasure for me to give a talk in the Spintronics conference. And the subject is how to use some concepts from quantum information theory in order to treat quantum impurity models. And I think it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek would like to call this really useful quantum information theory. I myself have my name on grants that claim that using quantum computation we will revolutionize computing. Well, that's a long way to go still. But in this talk, I will tell you about an example where tools from quantum information theory really helped to improve the numerical performance of some standard methods for treating quantum impurity models. So from my point of view, this is really, really useful and fascinating. Now, the more detailed discussion will be how to what the connection is between the numerical renormalization group and the density matrix renormalization group. Those are two methods in condensed matter physics for renormalizing strongly correlated systems, which seem to have been quite distinct. Now, I should give all the credit to Andreas Weichselbaum, who's a postdoc in my group. The slides are by him. He did all the numerics. I basically just suggested the subject to him, and he took off. And the work grew out of a collaboration together with Frank Verstrate, who was at the time a postdoc in the group of Ignacio Cirac in Munich, and Uli Scholweg, who was for about a year my colleague in Munich before he went on to Aachen. He's a big expert on DMRG. And Frank and Ignacio are very prominent people in the field of quantum information theory. And my background was on these quantum impurity models. So that's how things came together. Now, by way of introduction, let me just briefly, for those that don't know what I mean by this word quantum impurity models, describe what that is. It's any model which deals with a local quantum degree of freedom, like a spin, or a few levels inside a quantum dot that are coupled to an environment with a continuum density of states. The first prominent example of such a model was a condo model, where you have a local magnetic impurity coupled to conduction electrons in a metal. Then the Anderson model is another example of that type. And in the late 1990s, when first people managed to realize condo physics using quantum dots, this whole area blossomed again. So my little cartoon here describes electrons traveling from a left lead through a quantum dot to a right lead through discrete energy levels. If you tune this such systems appropriately, you can get very fancy and complex many-body physics out of that. And all those models have this feature. You have a low quantum degree of freedom coupled to a bath. And the low temperature physics can become pretty intriguing and non-trivial, and so one needs methods to deal with those models. Now, Ken Wilson, in part of his work in which he developed the idea of renormalization group, also proposed a numerical method for dealing with such models, which has come to be known as the numerical renormalization group, or in short, NRG. And what he basically showed is how you could map such models onto a quantum chain. The quantum impurity sits at one end of the chain. The conduction bath, or the bath of continuous modes, is described by the rest of the chain. And then he developed a way to iteratively diagonalize this model and extract the interesting physics out of that. And I will explain in some detail during the talk how that is done. And this was an extremely successful method. With this, he was for the first time able to explicitly track the crossover from the recoupling fixed point to the strong coupling fixed point of the condo model, and really nailed what the low energy physics is. So this was really a landmark achievement by Wilson. Now, in the early 1990s, another type of renormalization group was proposed by Steve White. He was interested in studying quantum chain models, like spin chains or Hubbard models, and also allowing for disorder along these chains. And he developed a scheme for building up long chains from shorter ones and devised a method for keeping track of what the most relevant states are that you would have to keep track of numerically to get the low energy physics right. And to do so, and I will explain this later too, you end up constructing reduced density matrices of parts of this chain. That's why this method is called the density matrix renormalization group approach. And it's also very powerful, and Steve White and pioneered this, and a whole subfield of computational physics then arose around this method, and Uli Shorvik is one of the prominent people that I happen to interact with closely. But for until last year, people thought that these two methods were more or less distinct. It was not clear what the common, whether there is a common basis. And in fact, I have friends that that told me very adamantly they think there is no connection between them. But then, in the course of our discussions with Ignacio and Frank Verstraete, we realized that there is in fact a common mathematical basis, namely matrix product states. It turns out, and I will explain to you in detail what these are, that both this method and that method generate states that have the structure of matrix product states. And once one has realized that, a whole door of a whole new world of opportunities opens up numerically, because you can use all tricks that have been developed here, apply them there, and vice versa. So once you realize a common basis, a lot of exciting possibilities show up. And that I will try to explain all this to you. So just for those that don't know the acronyms, I summarize them here again. I will structure my talk as follows. I will tell you some motivation for why we want to study these quantum impurity models. I will give you a brief NRG review, but using modern language, namely the language of these matrix product states. And this part I will try to do in as much detail as necessary that you can understand the central claim: NRG produces matrix product states. And this idea is really simple. In the discussion, I remember this quite clearly with Uli and Frank and Ignacio, who were at a conference, and we decided to just explore this idea. Is there some connection? It took us just 5 minutes on the blackboard, and then it was clear there must be a connection, and the rest is just details. So this is, I hope that this message will get across quite well. Then I'll explain the relation to DMRG. I will mention some advantages of using this matrix product set formulation. Mainly gives you greater flexibility for doing numerics, and we'll say a few words about the outlook of using this method to do real-time evolution. So models where the Hamiltonian has some time-dependent parameters which you want to wiggle and follow the quantum evolution of the system. All right, so what are typical quantities one wants to calculate? Well, for one, you'd like to be able to have the Hamiltonian in diagonal form. You'd like to be able to calculate spectral functions which describe the dynamics of the quantum degree of freedom, the local impurity. And for models of this type, where you have one local degree of freedom, let's say this is a level in a quantum dot which can have spin up and spin down coupled to two leads, it's known that the spectral function or its Fourier transform has the Fourier transform of this Green's function has a very sharp resonance at the Fermi surface, which is called the Condor resonance. And if you study transport from left to right through this dot, this will result in anomalies in the conductance through the dot. And in order to calculate that conductance as a function of temperature, for example, accurately, you need to be able to calculate this function very precisely. And it's complicated by the fact that the width of this peak, which is called the Condor temperature, is exponentially small in the parameters of the model. So this is a pretty challenging thing to do, to calculate this numerically. Now, the NRG is able to do that and has been able to do that for many years. So one of the tests that we will have for a new method is whether we can reproduce the spectral function. All right, so correlation function and dynamical properties come through this spectral function. And then a little bit further along the road, we would like to be able to study situations where you suddenly change parameters of this model. For example, imagine you have a gate voltage attached to a quantum dot and you suddenly jerk down this energy level. That will change the quantum temperature, it turns out, and it will change the quantum correlations in a very non-trivial manner. And we would like to have a tool, a numerical tool, that nevertheless is able to describe the wave function, psi as a function of t, accurately as you change the parameters of the system. So that is a pretty ambitious goal. But such things are able by now to be done with DMRG. So once you have the connection between NRG and DMRG, one should be able to make that connection. All right. So let me give you an example of an explicit example of a quantum impurity model, the Anderson model. It describes a single local level with which can contain an electron spun up or spun down or doubly occupied, connected to one lead. Okay, since I'm in microscopic physics, I usually talk about two leads because we measure transport through this here, through this dot. But the original model just involved one bath of conduction electrons that is described by this term over here. And typically one assumes a flat density of states because on the scale of energies that we're interested in, features in the density of states don't matter. Then this term describes the position of this local level. The energy ED can be tuned by applying a gate voltage, for example, if it's a quantum dot. This term is the charging energy, which tells you that if you want to add two electrons to this local level, it will cost a lot of energy. That means that if this level is below the Fermi surface, on average, it will be occupied by a single electron and not two. And the single electron has a spin, so you see connections to the Condor model here. And then this term here allows electrons to hop from the dot into the local level. So this is the standard Anderson model. And my purpose will not be to describe the physics of this model, but to indicate how one can, how Wilson figured out a numerical way to treat it. Now, if I want to do a little cartoon for the geometry of this model, I would draw it like this. There's a local degree of freedom described by H dot, which is coupled to a lot of different levels in the leads. Each of these levels, labeled by energy E, is coupled individually to this dot. Okay, so it's sort of a star geometry. And if I would have to draw a Hamiltonian as a matrix for that, it would sort of have this structure. There's my local degree of freedom. These are the levels in the band. And this local degree of freedom is coupled to each of them. So Hamiltonian looks like this, with zeros here and zeros here. Okay? All right. And now what Wilson realized is that in order to describe the low-energy physics of the Condor model, remember this very sharp peak in the spectral function, you have to represent the states in the lead in a very clever manner. Namely, you should choose a logarithmic discretization which has very many states very close to the Fermi surface. So there's a logarithmically dense set of points, or exponentially dense set of points close to the Fermi surface. So basically it represents all the states lying over here by in this energy interval by a single state, all the levels lying here by another state, etc. And that will allow him to resolve the physics around small energies very accurately. And this is done in terms of by introducing a discretization parameter bigger than 1, lambda, typically it's of order 2, and choosing these intervals to the positions where these energy, these intervals are separated to be powers of inverse powers of lambda, okay? So the bandwidth has unit width, and then this is lambda to the minus 1, lambda to the minus 2, etc. Okay, and then by basically tridiagonalizing this Hamiltonian, you can bring it into the form of a quantum chain where you have just a diagonal and one line away from the diagonal terms. So basically you have still the dot Hamiltonian, and then you have hopping along basically along this chain here. So you introduce new degrees of freedom, which I indicate by points along a quantum chain. And due to this logarithmic discretization, the hopping strength along this chain, this is a hopping term, decrease exponentially. So as n, the index along the chain, increases, the coupling strength becomes weaker and weaker. So the basic idea is the further you go along this chain, the more you resolve the low energy features, but the less strong the coupling of these terms is. Okay, so that's a very simple standard step. And then the question is how to deal with this Hamiltonian. Okay, and so what Wilson does is he diagonalizes it iteratively. You start with a very short chain that you can diagonalize exactly. Then you add one more site to the chain, diagonalize that exactly too. And then at some point when the Hilbert space becomes too big, you throw away the high-lying states, you retain just 500 or so states, the lowest 500 states. Add one more site, diagonalize that too, throw away the high-lying states again. And in this way, focus on what the behavior of the lowest lying states is. And in the end, you get a spectrum for the low-lying states from which you can extract interesting properties. Let me just give you typical examples. You plot, if you plot the energy of the lower states that you've kept in your calculation as a function of site index as you go along the chain, you see some complicated evolution. And this is also always plotted in units of the lowest energy scale that you're resolving. Okay? Then you get some complex crossover behavior and then a fixed point spectrum. And from this fixed point spectrum, you can extract useful information like critical exponents of the model or transmission phase shifts, which you need to calculate zero temperature transport. There's a whole technology for how to extract physics from this plot, which is not the subject of my talk today. I just want to show this is one type of thing you want to do. For that, you have to diagonalize this Hamiltonian iteratively. And then you can calculate the spectral function by combining the information that you've collected along the way. And an example for this Anderson model in a finite magnetic field, it would have a central peak. When the field is small, the central peak would split up into two, and there are side peaks associated with these local atomic levels. But again, the physics of this curve is not what I want to deal with today. I want to open for you the black box a little bit by which you calculate this stuff. All right. So this is now the most important slide of my talk. How does energy actually go about this whole thing? All right, so we really now have to imagine this chain, this quantum chain, and each site on this chain has four possible degrees of freedom for the Anderson model. For example, let's take the local site again. Maybe I should just draw it here as I go along. So I'm thinking of such a chain, and the first site describes the local spin, the local level, which can be empty, have a spin up or spin down, or be doubly occupied. And if I couple this to one lead, then each further site along this chain describes an electronic state, which likewise can be empty, singly occupied, or spin up, spin down, or doubly occupied. Okay, so there's a Hilbert space consisting of a direct product of all possible configurations of this state here, all possible configurations of this state here, etc. And this value sigma, for each of them can take these values. Okay. So the local state space, the dimension of this dot has dimension 4 in this example. And now we want to build up a chain. Okay, so if you start really with only the first site, the total dimension of my Hilbert space is just 4. And there are 4 possible states. And this notation will become clear in a second. And those 4 states, I can make arbitrary linear combinations of them. So I have 4 possible states, which are linear combinations of these basis states. Now if I add one more site to the chain, I have, 2 sites. I can diagonalize Hamiltonian for this very short chain. The total Hilbert space is now 16-dimensional. And the new eigenstates, J, of a chain which includes the first site from the conduction band, these new eigenstates are linear combinations of the old ones with the states on this new site over here. Okay, so if I just go back, these were my old states. If I take a linear combination of those with the basis states of the second site, I can arrange the indices or the coefficients of this linear combination in a matrix whose first index I tells me what state from the old basis I took. The second, the superscript tells me what state from this local basis I'm using, and the second index of the matrix tells me what new state I will get. So I will have 16 states of this type. The 16 states are labeled by J runs from 1 to 16, and they have this structure. Okay, so if this is not clear, stop me here. This is the one part of the talk that I hope really will connect. Now I can continue. I add yet another site. The total Hilbert space will now be 4 to the 3 dimensional, 64. And I can diagonalize the Hamiltonian in this space. And I will get 64 different states labeled by index k, and they will be linear combinations of the states I had before, times direct product, the states in the new, describing the new site, and I can again choose, arrange the coefficients of this linear combination in this matrix structure, where each time the superscript labels which states from the new site I'm using. And so I can continue. All right, and as you continue, you notice that the total dimension of the total Hilbert space blows up exponentially. So at some point you will have to truncate. So let's say after the first step, you decide, you know, you're not going to be able to keep track of 4,000 states. You'll keep track only of 1,000 states. So then, out of these 4,000 states in the NRG procedure, you decide to throw away the higher-lying ones, and you just retain the lowest 1,024. There were 4,000 of these guys. You just keep the lowest 1,024. Okay, that's where the truncation sets in. And Wilson's criterion was simply, I'm going to use the low-lying states because they will be relevant for getting out the fixed-point physics. Okay, so this is the key truncation step. At this point, it begins to become inexact. And then you continue. You add yet one more site. You increase the total number of states again, truncate, and so you can, and so on. So instead of keeping all the states, all the 4 to the k states, you just choose that number. So this I will call the dimension of my matrices. Okay, so I should emphasize this. These matrices here, for each value of sigma. So sigma can have one of these four values. These matrices are 1024 times 1024 dimensional matrices, okay? Because L and M have this many values. So the result, the net result, is called a matrix product state, and you can see why. Because if I just rewrite it like this, I have some product of matrices. Here you can see the indices N, M, L, are contracted as a product of matrices, and those matrices carry additional labels that tell you which out of these states I should pick out. Now, I still have quite a large number of parameters in these matrices. For example, well, let's just count them. If I have a site of if a chain of length n, and let's just count from the point where the matrices have fixed size, then each of those matrices, for each site, there are d matrices, and they each have dimension m squared, where m would be this number 124. So this is the total number of parameters that are used to describe that state. But this is, in general, much, much less than 4 to the power of, than d to the power of n, if n is big. Okay, so it's a reduced description, but it still has very, very many parameters inside it. All right, so this was basically the main realization, and this was, you won't find this type of analysis or written it up in this way in Wilson's paper, that and it's really a trivial statement, that NRG produces matrix product states. Now, yes? Yes. So it's after truncation, which means all these matrices starting from set 5 have the same dimension. We cannot keep track of ever bigger matrices. Okay, so that is approximation. All right, now again, this is the key key observation, that this NRG generates a metric product state, and these types of cartoons were very useful now. The left and the right legs indicate the contraction of neighboring matrices, and these little lines coming down, they indicate to which of the basis states, the local basis states, I'm going, right? So I'm not going to write all the stuff each time, just remember that. Now what Wilson, I described to you what truncation criterion he used. It was just to keep the lowest energy states at each iteration. But once you realize that the state has this structure, you can do something else. You can say, well, let's use all those matrix elements as variational parameters. Let's construct just the expectation value of the ground state energy as an expectation value of a state of the Hamiltonian with the state of the structure, and variationally choose the parameters of this Hamiltonian so that we get the lowest possible value. And that in principle will give you something better than what Wilson did, because Wilson's criterion is clever and it works very well, but it's not optimal in any way. And once you realize that the state has a structure, you can say, well, there might be a slightly better choice of parameters, which will give you a somewhat lower ground state energy.
Yes? A lot of parameters there, right?
Yes.
I mean, all sure. The entries and all the matrices,
yes,
are independent.
Yes. Yes. So the idea is simple. The implementation will be non-trivial. You'll need some clever numerics to get this to work. Okay. But in principle, you can do better than what NRG does. And I will explain the benefits as we go along. But let me just point out one thing, for example, right away. Once you have this, how do you do this variational optimization? You can take a state with an arbitrary value of the matrix at the beginning. You can just really take random numbers if you wish. And then keep all the matrices constant, but just minimize the entries of the first matrix. Or optimize the entries of the first matrix to minimize energy. Then you go to the next one, keep this one fixed, keep those fixed, optimize this matrix, and continue along the chain, so you sort of sweep through the chain, improve the state, and then when you reach the end, you come back, you go back and forth a few times, and you find out that this thing converges pretty nicely. This is the way Frank Verstraete did it. Alternatively, you could take Wilson's state, the one that you produced doing energy, as starting point, and then try to optimize it. But even if you start really from a random point in this total space of matrix product states, pretty quickly you converge to a very good approximation for the ground state. So this thing is called sweeping. Yes?
Is the difference in the rate of convergence?
Yes, I will get to that. It turns out that this matrix product state description, once you've realized it, you can use a more economical way of representing all the information. Let me get to this. We actually did not yet do this, what I just claimed, that you can take the NRG state and continue to improve it iteratively. At the moment, our code just starts from a random point, but it converges pretty quickly, like 10 or 12 sweeps, something like that.
How do you measure the optimization?
Well,
not just the minimum energy condition.
Well, since it's a variational idea that I'm describing, at each step you guarantee to improve the total energy. Each time you change one of these, or you try to improve one of these matrices, energy goes down. And well, you just keep track of how the energy goes down. I will show you plots of this.
It's just energy minimization.
Yes, it's just energy minimization.
I'm a constraint of more, I think.
Yes, absolutely. So what else do I... Okay, and the advantages which I will get to as we go along is once you are no longer reduced to just sweeping through the system once, like what Wilson does amounts to just doing one sweep. It takes the first matrix and the second, reaches the end. You know you've reached the end according to Wilson when this finite size spectrum no longer changes, and then you stop. Now, since we can go back and forth, we're no longer tied to using this logarithmic discretization, as I will explain. And I also have a slide on showing that you can use this to good effect using more complex geometries than 1D. But before I do this, let me just give you the connection to DMRG, because it was known for quite a number of years that DMRG, this scheme of Steve White, also produces matrix product states. Now, for those of you that don't know what DMRG is about, I have a schematic slide here. There, your goal is just to numerically treat a standard quantum chain model. It could be a spin chain, Heisenberg chain, or a Hubbard chain. And you start by using a small system consisting of just two sides, and then you want to add more and more sides to the system, making it bigger and bigger, and keeping track all the while only about of the most relevant states. So they introduce the notion of a system and an environment, two blocks in the left and right of these initial sites. At the beginning, this would just be empty. Then diagonalize the Hamiltonian. You split the system artificially into two parts, and then you describe the left part by what amounts to a matrix product state, and the right part by a matrix product state. Then you add two more sites in here. For this part, you have a numerical description in terms of a matrix product state. For this one, two. Now you just make the total Hilbert space bigger. You diagonalize the Hamiltonian in the total. You diagonalize the Hamiltonian in the new Hilbert space, and then you throw away certain number of states. And in this throwing away step, what you basically do is you trace out the left side. You have a reduced density matrix for the right side. You calculate its eigenvalues, and you keep only the states with the biggest eigenvalue, the most relevant states. And then that part you use to describe the right side and add back the left side and continue. So that's a whole technology that I don't want to get into. My main point is simply to this. This whole scheme produces matrix product states of exactly the same structure as the NRG. Okay? And then if you have a system that is not homogeneous, you want to do what's called finite size DMRG. So you sweep this part where you sort of take the chain apart into two parts. You sweep it to the left and to the right, and in this way optimize this part of the left part of the chain and the right part of the chain until you've hopefully gathered enough information from the entire thing that you have an accurate description. So again, you don't need to understand the details of this. The only point is the underlying type of state has the same structure as for NRG. Right, so what we did, when you variationally optimize such a state, you don't take out two sets at a time, you take out one, optimize this thing variationally. So variationally optimizing this matrix and that one, then that one, then that one is, in effect, equivalent to what Steve White figured out. This was only understood a few years after his initial paper, but it's fair to say that was standard knowledge in the DMRG community. So once we've realized that NRG has matrix product states, we know it's equivalent to DMRG, and we can lift all the tricks from the toolbox that they developed. All right, so how well does it work? The idea is simple. Let me show you some data to illustrate what we did. So on the right side, I show you a finite size spectrum calculated using conventional NRG for the single level Anderson model, certain parameters of this model here. And on the left side, I show you the energy levels calculated with this matrix product as, approach, where you basically, what you do is you first find an optimized description of the entire chain, starting from some random initial parameters, sweep till the whole thing converges, and then you can calculate the effective Hamiltonian describing the chain at a certain position along the chain. And that effective Hamiltonian, its eigenvalues, are plotted here. And you can see that these two seem to agree completely, and they do up to 4 or 5 numerical decimals. So it really works very well. What is plotted here is the ground state energy as a function of iteration number. And you see this, what I call here the DMRG approach, or the matrix product state approach, that's much better. It's much converges much more quickly than the other one. And the other thing to point out is that the number of states per site that I have to keep, or the dimension of these matrices, for the DMRG is 32, and for the NRG is 124. So here I have to keep much, much more states than here to get an accurate description. And I'll explain to you why that is a few slides down the line. So on this level, the results are equivalent, but you get them with much less work, much less numerical resources using a DMRG approach.
Is there anything the NRG gives you that the DMRG doesn't? I mean, you've done a lot of extra work.
No. I would claim you can do better with DMRG, period. You can redo everything you do with NRG. You're working in the same Hilbert space. So once you've realized that, you can redo anything you want with NRG, from NRG using the DMRG tools. And you can do a lot of more things more. I'll explain as we go along.
Does that mean you can now do the usual NRG calculations at a much, much bigger system size?
Exactly. I'll get to that. Well, particularly you can treat models with more leads, or more complex models. You can treat models that are more complex.
Yeah, but the same model, could you do it at a bigger system?
Yeah, well, bigger system size means effectively longer NRG chains, right? But they converge after a while anyway. So once it's converged, it doesn't matter.
How about the conservation of misery?
Okay, that's a good and relevant question. It turns out you need quite some more technology. This is technology on the level of linear algebra, and these programs were originally written using MATLAB. So it's simple in the sense that once you know linear algebra, you know what to do, but you have to, the sweeping involves a lot of rearrangement of the information. And you can do this in efficient ways or not so efficient ways. And if you're clever, you build in quantum numbers. If you don't use quantum numbers, then you carry along lots of redundant information. And to get all this to work is a lot of work. But since in my group, quantum computer models is one of our main things we do, I thought we should get it along. And I'll show you some ways where you can save energy later. So there's an initial investment, which is significant, but I think it's, from my point of view, it's worthwhile. So for the spectral function, the way you can, this is how it's defined as a function of frequency. Well, you basically have to take an expectation value of C and then inverse Hamiltonian, this resolvent over here with C dagger between the ground state after n iterations, and the spectral function is the imaginary part of this object. So this is what you have to calculate numerically. So let me introduce some notation to summarize it. Let me call this state C, and then the resolvent acting on that state C I call chi. In DMRG language, this is called the correction vector. And you basically have to calculate the inner product between this state here with the state chi. Okay, that's what you have to do. And so once you know chi, you're done. Okay, so chi is defined by this equation, and this is also now a question in linear algebra: how do I determine chi? And Andreas used the following scheme: he forms a certain inner product, takes the derivative with respect to A. This equation basically reproduces that one if you do it abstractly. If you do it concretely and you take these derivatives one by one, you can sort of pick out the coefficients of one of these matrices one at a time. So you solve this equation for each of the separate matrices in your matrix product state. So do this iteratively and you eventually get the state chi out, and then you calculate the inner product. If you're interested in details, you can ask me later. There's one technical thing: this imaginary part here always has to be bigger than the energy resolution, the smallest energy between consecutive levels. And so as you go along the chain, it just becomes smaller and smaller and smaller, which means the numerics have to be quite accurate. You can get all this to work, and you can calculate spectral functions which agree with NRG results very nicely. I wouldn't say it's trivial to get this to work, but it's doable. All right, so this is just sort of proof of principle that the method works just as well as NRG. What are the advantages? Why am I excited about this? Well, the main advantage, it's more flexible. And let me explain several of these points where flexibility is important. When you do NRG, lengthening the chain works as follows. Let me go into more detail now. This chain is actually a double chain in NRG. There's one chain which only involves spin up, one chain which only involves spin down, and they don't talk to each other because in the conduction band we don't have interactions in this model. The only site where the spin up and spin down talk to each other are in the at the impurity site, where it costs an energy U if you have the impurity site W occupied. So this is actually, it's not necessary to keep these two parallel. But in the NRG, what you do when you lengthen the chain, you add both of those sites simultaneously. Then you add these two, then you add these two, and you represent the whole thing as a matrix product state, where sigma is basically, and this is the way I explained it previously also, contains these four states, okay? And so each of these blocks actually has a direct product structure of a spin-up block and a spin-down block. But you don't exploit this when you do NRG. You just don't even recognize this. Once you've recognized that they don't talk to each other, you can basically unfold this chain, put the spin ups on one side, the spin downs on the other side, and now you can optimize these matrices individually. You don't have to add them at the same time. And that turns out to gain you a lot of numerical efficiency. So, and this is the reason. This is the reason why, for the DMRG method using this approach, we got away with a much smaller system size than for the NRG. Because basically, this is basically the point. In NRG, you calculate this matrix explicitly, and you don't exploit the fact that it's a direct product of two individual bases. In this matrix product set approach, we effectively calculate just one of them and realize the other one has a very similar structure. Okay, and that gives you a huge increase in efficiency. Now, this increase in efficiency is going to be especially useful if you study more complex models. For example, Anderson model coupled to two leads instead of one. This would be the first lead, spin up, spin down. This would be the second lead, spin up, spin down. Gray is first lead, yellow is second lead. And in the NRG, when you increase the length of the chain, you have to add all these sites at the same time. And then at the next step, you have to increase all those states at the same time. And that means if you... it would not be necessary because the geometry is actually a star geometry. Each of these effective leads are independently of the other ones, and it would be more efficient to just add a site here, then a site there, then a site there, then a site there. And let me just do the counting with you. Suppose I have k channels. In this example, I have two. Then each of these dots here represents, and I presented each of these channels by chain, then each site on the chain has dimension 2 for spin up or spin down, and in the in the NRG case, the number of states I have to add at a single go is d to the 2k. So when k was equal to 1, this was 2 to the 2 was 4. These were the 4 states I added previously. When k is 2, it will be 2 to the 4, which is 16 sites, which I have to add at a single go. But when I treat those trains individually, each time I just have to add two sites. So instead of adding 16 states at a time, I just add two at a time. And so the size of the effective matrices that I have to keep in the DMRG can be much smaller than with NRG. And that's what gives you a lot of gain. Now, if you're not into the numerics, you might shrug about this, but this is a huge, numerically very important thing. All right, and so I'm hopeful that we'll be able to do more complex models, like two or three lead things, or also the number of local states where energy just hits a wall because it gets too complex. Right, yeah, so you add the numbers. This is the difference between keeping 32 states or 1,000 states. Okay. All right, now I'm... Now the next thing I want to explain is that you can optimize the way you allocate information along the chain. In NRG, you just treat all the matrices along the chain to have the same size. This is not necessary. You can do better. And this is where the tools of quantum information theory really come into force. So suppose you've optimized your description of the chain numerically, and then you ask yourself, well, am I wasting resources? Am I wasting memory? And then you can find out whether you do that by, at a random point in the chain, representing that matrix product state as a bipartite system consisting of a left part and a right part. So you can write that state, basically you can organize it like this, that there's a left part of the chain, and the and you then you sort of treat this particular side explicitly. There's a right part of the chain, you treat that side explicitly, and you can write the matrix product state as a linear combination of states describing the left part and the right part. This is just a way of reorganizing information. And then you can now ask how strongly is the left part entangled with the right part? If they are not at all entangled, then I'll basically be able to write the total state as left times right, and that's it. If they're entangled, there will be many linear combinations of this type. And the more strongly they are entangled, the more states I will need to treat them. Okay? Basically, if they were not entangled, it would not be necessary to put a big fat matrix in here to connect them. It would be sufficient to just use a single number. If I need a big fat matrix here, it means they're strongly entangled. So it would be interesting to be able to characterize how strongly this side is entangled with that one. And that's something that quantum information people have known how to do for a long time. What you basically do is you trace out, for example, the right side of the system, get a reduced density matrix for the left side, and that reduced density matrix you can represent in this fashion. Then diagonalize it, and calculate the so-called bipartite entanglement. So you take the eigenvalues of this matrix, let me call them rho alpha, there will be a huge number of them, we form this combination of them, and this sum over eigenvalue log eigenvalue of the density matrix is called the bipartite entanglement. It turns out it doesn't matter whether you calculate it by first tracing out the right side and doing this for the reduced density matrix describing the left side, or vice versa, you always get the same number. So this entropy gives you a measure of how strongly the left and the right hand side are entangled with each other. And then as an estimate for the optimal size of the matrices that you should use here in order not to throw away information, you can use this construction. So if all the states in this if all the states in these matrix product states would contribute would carry the same weight in terms of constructing the total state, this constitutes of order 1, and then you would basically say D is the number of degrees of freedom that you have in there, which is E to the entropy, or that's where the entropy is usually defined. Entropy is log of the number of degrees of freedom. Now it turns out that not all states contribute with the same weight. Some of them contribute only very slightly, so you need to put in a certain fudge factor, a constant over here. But roughly speaking, you can say but if you calculate this entropy of entanglement, it gives you a measure of how big the matrices need to be here that you're using. Now, let me show you how this works in practice. So Andreas did the following very neat thing. He starts with a matrix product state in which all the sites on the chain are characterized by the same matrices of the same size. So here we plot the number of kept states per site, per site number. The center of the chain is over here. Spin up is this way, spin down is that way. And here, the fact that this dotted line is flat just means all the matrices have the same size. Then, using that matrix product state, you calculate this entropy of entanglement as a function of site, of position along this chain, and you calculate this object, E to the entropy times some fudge factor. And then you get this blue line. And then you see that actually way out in the wings, you don't need to use such big matrices. You could get away with using much smaller ones. Whereas in the center, you should be using bigger matrices because actually you don't have enough information to describe, you don't have enough numerical resources using matrices of size 32 to describe what's going on over here. And right in the center, there's a big dip. And the reason for that is that the spin up and spin down parts of the chain are not very strongly entangled. Actually, we know it's a singlet, right? So you should be able to write the total state as one part describing spin ups plus one part describing spin downs minus opposite. So right there's very little entanglement. Entanglement starts happening when I move from one side to the next, going into the conduction band. And that is very nicely reflected here. Okay, and then having realized this, you can now take a more clever numerical description. Use smaller matrices out here. So this is now this red line. Use smaller matrices out here, bigger ones in here. Re-optimize the chain, recalculate the entropy of entanglement, and then you find that you basically can get the same structure here, meaning using less resources, you've captured, you've described the state just as well as you did previously. Now this type of thing is something which really opens up the structure of your numerics and allows you to optimize where you need it. This is something which I really like, which is not at all done with NRG. And I think the more complex the models, the more important this type of thing will be. All right, and now just one other point. Why does this thing drop down here? Well, it turns out as you move away from the center of the chain, you basically look at the system at smaller and smaller energy scales. And this point over here corresponds to the Kondo temperature. So to describe the initial flow of the energy levels, that is done by this part of the chain. And then beyond here, you see nothing interesting happens. That's why you don't need a lot of information. And indeed, the size of the matrices that you should be keeping is also dropping.
That makes sense.
All right, I'm almost done. Let me just say a few words about prospects of what we can do with this method. Now, the first thing is, since the method is variational, it doesn't rely on this logarithmic discretization so much. This is a point I didn't emphasize so far. The fact that that you use logarithmic discretization in Wilson's scheme is very important because it implies that the couplings drop along the chain, and that means the feedback of information from small energies to big energies is very little. Because each time you add a site to the chain, you put up the chain very slightly. And that's why Wilson was able to get away with sweeping only once. However, it also means that you don't have good resolution in your spectral function at high energies. So, recall the spectral function, the Kondo model had such a structure. And out here, you just have a few states. Over here, you have very many states, which allows you to resolve this. But here, you don't have many states. And you couldn't, in Wilson's scheme, add many more states here. You couldn't simply add some more states to resolve this peak here, because then the couplings along the chain would not fall off so smoothly, and there would be feedback information from small to high energy scales. But with a variational approach, we don't worry about that. You say, okay, let there be feedback, then we'll sweep some more times, and we'll keep track of that. So that will allow us, in principle, to resolve such things better, or if you apply magnetic field and you split this peak, to resolve those peaks narrowly. So basically, you have access to information at big energy scales more accurately than with NRG. And this means you can apply to applications where you need a non-consonancy of states, like in dynamical mean field theories, where you basically map a system of interacting system onto an effective quantum impurity model with a complex density of states and use NRG as a quantum impurity solver. So I think we are not there yet, but I think this is one important prospect. And then the one I'm most hopeful for is time dependence. So in DMRG, people have figured out ways to solve this equation explicitly. If you know psi is a matrix product state, and you want to calculate psi time t plus dt, then you just have to apply the time evolution operator. And I'm just going to be very generic. If you know the state in a matrix product basis, you can also calculate this one using a set of tricks which people in DMRG have used. And all those tricks you can carry over. And let me show you just as an advertisement some of the nice things that Uli Shawverk recently did. He had a simulation. This is now not quantum impurity, but just a Hubbard chain, a 1D chain, and he explicitly showed spin charge separation. Now, this is not a surprise, but it's nice to see it numerically. What he basically did is he took a 1D system, electrons were spun up and spun down. In the center, made a charge inhomogeneity, a bump in charge, at t equal to zero by basically putting a potential drop there so the charge would peep up. And then switch off this potential drop so that you have a flat potential and see how this charge bump evolves. And then, unfortunately my colors are not very good here. What you basically see there's the charge hump spreads out into two humps moving to the left and the right. And if you do the same thing, if you plot the spin density, there are also two humps, but they spread with different velocities. And this you can really simulate as a function of time. Now, similar things, I think, should be doable for this quantum impurity models. All right, so these are my conclusions. At the moment, we are at the proof of concept level. We have not done any of these fancy outlook things that I'm promising, but I think I don't see any hurdles in principle to doing that. And I would like to give credit to all these people for discussions, and basically to Andreas Weichselbaum, who's the guy that made all this work, and to Frank Verstraete, who was the guy that wrote the first working code using MATLAB. Andreas is optimizing that, but those are the two guys that made this whole thing work. Thanks a lot for your attention. So, finite temperature, there are two avenues to doing that. The first one would be to follow the energy approach, where basically you have to weigh the states that you keep when you do a spectral. When you represent, for example, the spectral function in a Lehmann representation, those states enter with the Boltzmann weight. And if you have a better description of the matrix product state, then you also get better spectral functions. But that is just redoing energy maybe in a slightly optimized way. The second possible way of doing it would be to do this real-time evolution along the imaginary time axis. Right? You can represent this Boltzmann factor e to the minus beta h. You could pretend that's a time evolution along the imaginary axis, and if this time evolution here works, it should also be possible to do that using explicit time evolution. But that has not been demonstrated so far. So we'll try that more or less at the same time when we try the real-time stuff. But even if that turns out to be tricky, suffice it to say, we can use this finite temperature energy technology, and there's also a version called density matrix energy developed by Walter Hofstadter. One can do that more systematically using these matrix product states and get spectral functions that are guaranteed to be normalized to unity and so on. So there's some technical advantages there too. But we don't have such data yet. Yeah?
You might call the method as a very smart way of devising a variational wave function.
Yes.
Is there some similarity or overlap with the variational wave function used in many ways?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So I would, indeed there is a way you can make contact with that notion of variational wave function. Let me see where am I? I have to get the slide. Yes, if you do variational approach, if you do mean field theory, but what you would typically do is you would have one parameter for each side of the chain. So your matrices here would be one-dimensional. Now, we know mean field theory doesn't work in many cases, and that's because that one parameter per side is too small. And, what can I say? If you need an accurate description, you simply have to use more parameters. There's a well-established variational scheme for the Condon and Anderson models by Schönhammer and Gunnarsson, which tried to construct the total ground state as a linear combination of a state where you have the local level occupied, the conduction band, just the Fermi C, plus a state where there's the local level electron has hopped into the Fermi C, into all possible places, plus a set of states where another hole was created by this thing hopping back, and then you have coefficients for all these. But that gets cumbersome once you have more than a few particle hole excitations.
Might help to get some physical intuition on
what
the
weight function is. Well, there are many analytical approaches to the quantum model which give you intuition. If you want to do this, it's because you want to have reliable results. And I don't, at this point, think it makes sense to analyze matrix element XY of the fifth matrix here. It's just what you need to do if you want a Dirac-Lasalle Hamiltonian. If you want to, and I should also say this, most good NRG papers that I know do more than just show you the results. They then compare the limits with known limits and local limits, etc. So you should supply extra analysis beyond the numerics. But if you want to do the numerics reliably and accurately for big systems, you have to go through all this stuff. Yeah?
Okay. Really pure to modify the Anderson model. All the, for example, the P parameter is somehow really loud because the purity of the particle barns that you find by the centrifugal barrier and not there is with energy, so somehow it's something much more complicated. And can your model do that for the complications or methods?
Well, what you need is some effective, before you attach the lead, you need some effective set of energy levels for the local level. So if you are, I would ask like this, if you consider the atom that makes impurity in isolation, and you are able to characterize in terms of set of energy levels, and for each of those energy levels you can calculate matrix elements for how strongly they would couple to a continuum, then basically, if you're telling me the physics you're talking about means you have to keep track of more energy levels than the two that I was talking about, okay, we can add them back in. But this whole technology starts from having a discrete set of having a local Hamiltonian, n by n Hilbert space where n is small, say 5 or 10 or something, right? And coupling that to a continuum, that's what we want to keep track of. Now, if you want to add sophistication into how to describe this local system, you're welcome to do so. Just the more levels you keep track of, the more complex this thing gets. But that's why we would like to develop more efficient numerics, so then you can keep track of bigger local systems. So for the rare earth systems, where you have multi-level Anderson models, not just two levels, but a whole set of them, it quickly becomes very important to have efficient numerics. The Anderson model, according to my knowledge, there's just one guy that does three lead multi-level Anderson models, that's Tomasz Pruszka, and in my group with standard energy, when we try to do two levels with two leads and spin, we're sort of hitting the wall of where things don't get efficient anymore, or don't work efficiently anymore. But I think we will be able to go much more into more complex models this way. Yeah. Jan?
I have a question. How much important is this Wilson discretization in your approach? Because recently there was a paper by Hans Brava, which they use just VNIP to calculate Anderson model with the lead. They got somehow compared to standard energy very bad result for spectral function. They were not able to avoid the final size.
Well, what you're referring to, as far as I understand, is Hans Kroon studied Anderson model in real space, at, where these sites would really describe a one-dimensional lattice in position space and one single site singled out. And then it's clear that if you want to resolve the spectral function at small energy scales, you need an extremely long chain, and that's very difficult to reach. Therefore, my credo has always been, following Wilson, one should go into energy space and formulate what you want to do there. Now, you will still need to have very many states at small energies to resolve this feature here, but I don't see any reason why you cannot add some more states here and break this logarithmic discretization scheme over here. It will just mean you will have to sweep back and forth across your chain in energy space more diligently. But I don't see any reason why that should not work. Having said that, we have not gotten this to work yet. We are still in the process. But at this moment, I think I don't see any reason why it should not work. Yeah, but I have much more powerful tools than what he's been using. So we can turn that crank up quite a bit. So we can play around. We can really put these points by hand wherever you want them. And at the moment, people don't do this, and it works very well, but you cannot resolve this thing better. So I don't see any reason why if you add a few more states here and you sweep more, why you should not be able to get improved results. We can discuss details about that afterwards, if you're more interested. There was one, yeah?
Actually, it's related to this question of discretization. There are other schemes that people use for the energy, this lambda with some
exponent.
Is this something that would also carry over, meaning to the neural net method, meaning that if it's good for energy, it would be good here?
Yes, absolutely. I can say that immediately. Whatever you do, answering Greg's question also, whatever you can do with energy, you can do this way too, plus some more things. And it's basically, it just shines the flashlight on what the intrinsic structure of that energy state is. Once you've realized that, you can analyze it better and optimize it better. But whatever you've been able to do up to now, you can still do. Yes? Yes.
How much time you need to use this picture one method and how much other one?
Well, your computers. If you choose the size of the matrix is the same. On the one hand, you can use the same along the chain. So on the one hand, the matrices are much smaller. On the other hand, you have to do more with them. You have to sweep back and forth, you have to iterate many times, so I think it's sort of similar. But if you want detailed statements about what works more quickly, you should ask Andreas. I do think what we do is more involved, and so on average it will mean more work. But not only numerically, also not only in programming, but also letting the codes run. But the results are much better. Oh, okay. For the standard energy results, they're comparable. But in principle, they are better, and I'm sure there are situations, for example, large energy features, where the results of energy are simply not trustworthy. Yes. Yeah, and time dependence in particular. Look, I should have said this, if this perspective of having time-dependent numerics was not on the horizon, I would not have been so interested. I mean, then I would have thought, okay, it's an incremental improvement of energy. The systems where energy works well, why bother? But energy is very difficult to generalize to time dependence. There is a very interesting step in that direction by Fritjof Anders last year, where he managed to describe with energy tools, no matrix Planck states, a situation where you have an Hamiltonian, you switch one parameter, and then follow the time evolution. But having being able to treat the Hamiltonian H as a function of time, where H of T is an arbitrary function, he's not able to do that. Okay, one of the applications of all this will be qubits, right? A qubit coupled to a bath is a quantum impurity model. If you want to manipulate a qubit or two coupled qubits, like John Clark was telling us a few hours ago, and you want to keep track of how it gets entangled with a bath, you at some point, and it's not all recoupling, then you have to do this technology. So for that, you really need arbitrary time dependence for all the parameters in the local Hamiltonian, and you have to keep track of how it evolves, and that's what we want to do.
So I have a question about this time dependence. So which situation you can calculate? Does it mean some transient effect on you? Can you pop? You have no dissipation or something, so you cannot have.
Well, I have dissipation. The lead is the dissipation.
But it's your system is open.
Well, the lead is infinitely big. It's described by a continuum of states, right? The spin boson model, I could also, instead of by chain, could describe a spin boson model, describe a large number of harmonic oscillators, and they will certainly dissipate. So where's my time dependence slide? So I can describe, I claim that within the description of matrix product states, H can be any function of time, and I will be able to follow the time evolution. That's a claim. So it's a very strong claim. But it has been shown to work for these examples that I showed down here. Exactly. Because they just Dangler's Hamiltonian. And for this, you have to do more than Dangler's Hamiltonian. You have to follow. Uli likes to draw a plot like this with DMRG, which is maybe quite revealing. So if you want to describe time evolution, your total Hilbert space is some big structure. This is your initial state, and under time evolution it moves. Now if you do numerics, you optimize the states that you keep in order to describe this state and its immediate vicinity. And as you do time evolution, you'll move out of this state here. So you have to adapt the states that you keep during this time evolution. And that's why they call their method adaptive time-dependent DMRG. So you basically, as you move, you have to readjust your Hilbert space as you go along. But that can be done. There are methods for doing that. So it's a whole new ball game. So it's way beyond NRG. See, that's why I'm excited about it. Once you've realized the connection between NRG and DMRG, you can use all this. These tricks were developed by Jeffrey Vidal. And Uli Scholweck, independently of Steve White, and basically the same day they submitted their preprints to ConMed, because they're friends and they knew the other guys were doing something similar, so they coordinated the submission. So there's Uli Scholweck and Jeffrey Vidal and Corinna Collard, who was a PhD student in my group, and one more, a student of Jeffrey, did this together, and Steve White and co-worker. And this happened 2 years ago, about exactly 2 years ago now. And that technology can all be applied here.
The tidal circle.
Yes?
How do you know how large it is? Well, established how large it has to be?
Well, roughly speaking, well, if you want, the size of the circle is more or less how many parameters do you need to describe this. This is the number of parameters that I have available. And this is the number of parameters of the total Hilbert space, very roughly speaking, right? So if your circle is too small, you have to crank up M. You do a calculation once, and then you crank up M, and you do it again, and if nothing changes, yes. Or you do this entropy of entanglement business, right? There I showed you in the wings of the chain, the circle was bigger than it needed to be.
But so that there are no general sort of analytical type ways of estimating.
No, not that I'm aware of. What you do is you typically, I mean, M is a parameter in the theory, and nothing should depend on M. So change M, make M bigger. If nothing changes, you know you're good enough. And for this time evolution, for example, what happens then is. You evolve quite nicely, and after a certain number of steps, errors begin to accumulate very rapidly. And then you see that the M that you need suddenly explodes. And there are systematic reasons for that. Actually, if you read Uli's papers, he analyzes that in detail. So, excuse me? Yeah. No, it's. I mean, it's the type of numerics. I'm not a numerical guy. Those that know me know this. But, yeah, exactly. So this is. Okay, use the word deep. I would agree. It's deep numerics. It's not just simulating stuff, closing your eyes. Yeah, no, you have to know what you're doing. So that's why I'm very excited about it.
Just to make sure I understand, why can you do this? I'm not an energy person. So why can't you do time dependent with energy? You know, do the same kind of procedure you outlined there?
Well, okay, until 1 year ago I would have said it's just impossible even if you are the energy, what the NRG does, it gives you a description of the initial Hamiltonian. Well, it gives you a set of states for the initial Hamiltonian, okay, at all energy scales. But if H is a function of time, then as time moves on, you need a new set of states, which you would have to recalculate. And then as T goes on yet one more time step, you would have to recalculate those states too. This has simply not been figured out how to do yet. Then 1 year ago, Fritjof Anders did it for the simple situation that one parameter in Hamiltonian changed abruptly. He had these, so he calculated the set of states, let me call them E initial, depending on some quantum number N, and the set of states E final, E final also depending on some quantum number, and then he was able to approximately construct a time evolution using all the initial available states and all the final available states. And I think that's a major achievement. It's a really nice thing, and he did some analytical checks also for that to work. But now imagine that the Hamiltonian is not changing like that, but it's changing abruptly. Okay. So each time you have to rediagnose the whole thing, and there are simply more efficient ways to do it than doing energy at each of these time steps and gluing things together. Now, in principle it should be possible, let me say that, but it's going to be a big mess. And what you do with this scheme, what you do is you take dt to a small time step and then you do a trotter decomposition of this Hamiltonian in terms of, you write it basically as a sum of terms acting on the different sites along the chain. And then you sort of update the new state one site at a time. And in this way you construct the Hamiltonian at the next time slice. So if your state is represented like this, at time t, then you want to calculate at t plus delta t. So you first calculate this state anew, this site and this site and this site, because you've written the Hamiltonian sort of as a direct product of Hamiltonians on the successive sites. And then you one sweep then along the chain means one step in time space, and then you continue. You continue to doing it this way. But if you ask me too much about this, you'll embarrass me, because it's not the type of thing that I know in detail. I know it's doable, it has been implemented, and not only by one group, several groups are doing this. This is something we'll have to learn, but the tools are out there, we just have to implement them. Okay, so as you go along here, what you effectively are doing is you're singling out the which states you need to move along this path here. That's a philosophy. All right. Good. Thanks for the attention.